Our first case is 10 SA 191, Professi versus Brandenburg. There are other parties involved as well. Before we begin, I'd like to welcome the students from Rangeview Community College. Hope you enjoy your experience. And secondly, Justice Rice is ill. However, she will participate in the decision on this case, and she'll listen to the oral arguments. With that, are both parties ready? And before we begin, I just want to mention, please keep track of your own time. And secondly, when you start, please tell us who you are and who you represent. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Matthew Merrill, and I represent the objector cross-appellant Widefield Water and Sanitation District. I'm also speaking today on behalf of the objector cross-appellant City of Fountain and the applicants below, Peter and Catherine Lopresti. This court should reverse the water court's conclusion that the 1908 Beardsley Decree is void for lack of subject matter jurisdiction. The water court committed errors of both law and fact, but before getting to those, the geographical setting and the procedural history are crucial to understanding this case. This is a case that proves the old water law adage that it's better to be upstream with a shovel than downstream with a decree. And in this case, the Loprestis are downstream with a decree, and Mr. Brandenburg has been upstream with a shovel. The stream system here is unusual in Colorado in that it's a distributary stream system. Distributary. So Alvarado Creek, which is the subject stream, and there's a map up there that's it's just an enlargement from Appendix 1 of the opening brief, and the court can see about an inch up on the left side, Alvarado Creek flows diagonally up and to the right across the map, and it's draining out of the Sangre de Cristo Mountains, and up in the mountains it has tributaries adding to the main stem, just as in a traditional Colorado stream. But once Alvarado Creek starts to flow out across the valley floor, and the court can see this, it splits into separate branches. And those separate branches all have the same source of supply. They all have the same water coming out of the Alvarado Creek drainage in the mountains. And then at the bottom of the valley, Alvarado Creek and all of its branches are tributary to Great Creek, and Great Creek collects the flow at the bottom of the valley. Now the Loprestis have water rights on both branches of Alvarado Creek that are shown on the map there. Brandenburg, Mr. John Brandenburg, has junior water rights on the north branch of the creek. And Fountain and Widefield have an interest in the Bell Number 1 water right, which is up sort of in the upper right corner of the map on the main stem of the creek. The Bell Number 1 water right is the most senior water right on this stream system. There's not much water available in the Alvarado Creek system, and the record shows that since the time of the original adjudication, the stream has been heavily over-appropriated. Now, over time, the north branch of the stream became degraded, and the Loprestis began having difficulties diverting their flow at the decreed points of diversion, because when they would call for water down the north branch, it wouldn't make it through the degraded channel to their points of diversion. And in working with the division engineer to correct this situation, the Loprestis discovered errors, clerical errors, in their original decree. And so they filed the application below to do two things: to correct those clerical errors, and also to change points of diversion of some of their water rights to be able to take them out of the main branch of Alvarado Creek in order to not have to pull water through the degraded channel. They were trying to comply with the law and trying to continue their historical irrigation of the ranch. There was no change to export water here, no change in operations other than trying to irrigate the ranch. Now, Brandenburg, who, as I mentioned, has an interest in a junior water right upstream on the north branch, also owns land upstream on the north branch. He objected to the application. And in the case below, he consistently sought a declaration that the north branch of Alvarado and the main branch are two separate streams, and that the water rights on them should be administered separately. And the reason for this is that Mr. Brandenburg's rights on the North Branch are junior to many of the rights on the main branch. And so a declaration that these are separate streams would effectively move Mr. Brandenburg's rights higher in the priority system and provide him a more reliable supply. Mr. Brandenburg wanted the Beardsley Decree declared void because the Beardsley Decree says that the waters of these two branches are part of the same stream system and should be administered as part of the same stream system. So at bottom, this is a case about the viability of irrigation on a stream system with a chronically insufficient supply. And the court then...
The original adjudication was when for all these water rights?
There was an interlocutory decree in 1893, and that was finalized in 1896.
And they adjudicated all the water rights we're talking about
here? All of the water rights that we see here, yes, that's correct.
Okay.
And just to give the court an idea of the magnitude of the over-appropriation, the four water rights involved in the Beardsley Decree are priorities 1, 2, 3, and I think 5 or 6. And those water rights alone total 17 CFS. A lifetime resident of the Valley testified below that the only time he ever saw 17 CFS in the stream system was after a 5-foot snow, and that was the peak that he ever saw. Typically, a maximum stream flow is only 10 to 12 CFS.
On this map, would you tell us the point of diversion of those that were involved in the Beardsley Decree rotational fallowing agreement?
Yes. The first right is the bell number 1. It's up in the upper right corner of the map, WA bell number 1. That's the main branch. That's the most senior right on the stream. That's the right that Fountain and Widefield have an interest in. Then if the court follows the main branch down and to the left, past the ledgers 7 and 6, at the corner of this black or blue box here is ledger number 5. That's the next right that's involved in the Beardsley rotation. And then the other two rights, if the court follows the red and blue line north, maybe an inch, there's a whole group of dots there, but ledger number 11 and ledger number 12 are the other two rights. So we have bell number 1 and ledger number 5 on the main branch, and we have ledger number 11 and ledger number 12 on the north branch. Now, the court would not be surprised hearing this over-appropriated nature of the stream system to hear that this kind of a dispute has arisen before, and indeed it has, and this dispute about whether these are two separate streams or one stream arose in 1908 and was the dispute that precipitated the Beardsley Decree. Now in that case, and we need to go back to 1908 here, so parties' names change, but the water rights we're dealing with stay the same. In 1908, Mr. Beardsley owned the ledgered water rights that are shown on this map, and he sued to try to get a declaration that these are two separate stream systems in order to avoid calls from the senior bell number 1 water right against the ledgered rights. Alan Bates, who owned the bell number 1, answered that complaint, and in his answer he demurred and said that these are one and the same stream system with the same source, and that therefore, because all of the water rights on both branches have a single source, his bell number 1 right should be able to call out the junior ledgered rights regardless of which of the two distributary branches they're located on. Beardsley also sued the water commissioner, and the water commissioner answered that he had been treating this, and it was his understanding that it was a single stream system as well. Now, rather than litigate their dispute to a conclusion, the parties reached an agreement. It's known as the Beardsley Agreement, and that agreement in turn was confirmed by the court, and it was entered as a decree to settle the lawsuit. And what the Beardsley Agreement provided was that the parties would rotate the supply between them. And in effect, this works like a no-call agreement, except that we have one wrinkle here, and that is that there's two distributaries. And so the effect of the bell number 1 lifting its call for 4 days under the rotation means that the owner of the ledgered rights has a choice. They can divert water down the main branch to the ledgered number 5, or if they want, if it's most appropriate for the irrigation operations at that moment, they can also shift the water to the north branch and pull the water down the north branch to the ledgered 11 or 12. And so the rotation agreement provided an option to the owner of the ledgered rights that was unavailable if the bell number 1 was calling the limited supply down the main branch the entire time. It was very difficult to get a head of water down the north branch sufficient to push out across the fields and irrigate. And so the Beardsley decree solved this practical problem for the owner of the ledgered rights.
Well, now, were the Bell and these Ledger 11 and 12 and 8, were they senior to all these other rights or not?
The Bell number one is the senior right of the stream.
And then what happens?
And then the ledgered number 5 is the second right on the stream. And then the ledgered number 11 is the third right on the stream. So these are the first three. And then there's a couple more ledgered ditch rights that were owned by Beardsley but are not involved in the agreement. And then there's ledgered number 12. So effectively, these are a very senior group, and there's no water rights owned by other persons intermediate to this stack of priorities.
While you're at this point, could you address this confusion about how this decree then actually operated? I've read in the briefs that some have contended that, in fact, the, say, Bell number one was then entitled to the entire sum of all the water rights when it made that call.
Yes. That is Mr. Brandenburg's contention, that this decree changes points of diversion and allows any one of the headgates that are involved of these four rights to call the sum total of all of the rights. But there is no good evidence in the record that that's the way it operated. And in fact, the Loprestes have submitted substantial evidence at the summary judgment stage that that is not the way that the Beardsley decree operates. Now, the primary evidence that was advanced below for this operating as a call of one right, water right calling all of the rights in all four of the water rights is the deposition testimony of Keith Kepler. And he was an assistant division engineer. But he states in his testimony, in the excerpt that was attached to the summary judgment, that he doesn't have real good knowledge of how this operates. And as he's being questioned throughout that series of questions about how the decree operates, he keeps mentioning that this is his belief, but it's not his personal knowledge. And so that evidence is not persuasive about how the decree operated. And the Loprestes, in fact, submitted substantial evidence to counter that. And that includes the affidavit of their engineer, Thomas Williamson. Mr. Williamson testified that he reviewed the tabulation of water rights. The state engineer keeps a tabulation of water rights. And in that tabulation, the state engineer tracks or lists when there's been a change to a water right or when there's been an alternate point of diversion. And that tabulation was attached to the summary judgment response below. And it shows that the state engineer did not consider that the Beardsley decree changed any points of diversion of these water rights. Now, there was also an allegation below that the Loprestes had been taking water at an alternate point of diversion near the Ledgered 5 headgate and diverting Ledgered 11 and 12 water rights there. And Mr. Williamson also explained that the Loprestes had not been diverting the 11 and 12 into the Ledgered 5. So he refuted the allegation by Brandon Burst that the way the decree had operated was to have all of the water rights diverted through a single headgate.
I take it evidence of how the decree operated, and it seems to be that this operated for a long, long time since the decree, goes to the question how the decree should be construed, what the intent was in the language?
That's correct. The course of conduct of the parties is one source of information that the court can use in interpreting the decree to the extent that the plain language is ambiguous.
I don't mean to throw you off the progression you're going through, but would you explain an alternate interpretation of those words? What's you all's contention about how those words should be construed, what the intent of the operation was?
Yes. Well, as the court well knows, the plain language is the starting point for this decree. And the plain language of the decree has several very important terms that show the intent to rotate the call rather than to change alternate points of diversion. And the first is that the decree begins by reciting the original adjudication of all of these water rights. And it specifically mentions that they have been decreed to specific lands for specific uses and in specific amounts. And then in describing the rotation process back and forth, the Beardsley decree uses the term severally and respectively in defining what each of the parties can do with their respective water rights. And that's an important distinction here. Severally and respectively implies or suggests that the water rights must operate individually. It's different from a jointly and collectively concept that we'd expect to see if they were all supposed to be taken through the same headgate. There's an additional term here that's important, and that is the decree, every time it refers to the use of this rotated supply, uses the term lawful uses. It always limits the party's ability to use the water to the lawful uses. And reading that in context with the earlier reference to the original decree about the location of use and the decreed flow rates of use, that lawful is a strong evidence that the parties intended to rotate the call and not to move points of diversion.
What about the language, will not increase the burden for diversion of waters for irrigation purposes?
That's correct. That phrase confirms the fact that as long as these parties are operating only in accordance with their original decrees and their flow rates, their locations of use, that there is no enlargement. That's the concept that the court recently reiterated in Inglewood v. Burlington, where you said that a party, an inherent right in a water right, one of the bundle of sticks, is to choose when to call or when not to call. And parties can contract about when they place calls, and that's what's happened here. So at bottom,
could you just fill the last step for me there? It's probably obvious, but so what's the importance of putting in that language about point or points of diversion?
The importance was for the owner of the ledgered rights. The Bell right owner has one point of diversion down at the Bell ditch, and so on his 4 days, he gets to divert through the Bell ditch. But the ledgered right owners faced this difficulty that they had water rights on both branches, and so point or points meant to suggest that the ledgered rights owner could call down the main branch to the 5, or could call down the north branch to the 11 and or 12, or if it was springtime and there's enough supply to put water in both channels, he could call down to divert at all 3 points up to the lawful decreed rates. And so the court can see then that this is not like the case Fluke v. Ford, where the decree that created a change in points of diversion was expressed. It said, this water right shall be disconnected from a specific headgate and shall be diverted enjoyed, through a second headgate. Instead, the Beardsley has no mention of saying that the WA Bell number 1 water right can be diverted and enjoyed through the ledgered 5. That simply isn't the intent of the agreement. Now, as Justice Coates mentioned, the context of a decree is also important. And the court said in Hinderleiter v. Canyon Heights that a decree is a determination of a specific issue presented to the court, and it's grounded in the facts that created that issue. Now, what we have in the Beardsley litigation was a dispute over whether there was a single stream or whether there were two streams. And in that context, there was no application or no request by any of the parties to change points of diversion or to be able to operate each other's water rights. What we had was a dispute between two parties over a limited supply of water and arguing whether one's water right should be able to call out the other.
We have that complaint in the record, or whatever it was. What was the style of the action that was brought?
Yes, it was a civil action, and the entire record of the Beardsley action is attached to Mr. Brandenburg's motion for summary judgment below. And this information I just described to you is in the complaint and in the answer. Mr. Bates, who owned the Bell number 1, was a defendant, and so he answered and said, I should be able to call out rights on either branch of this stream.
Would you just briefly describe, if you can, what was the state of the requirement for service on other water right holders at the time of the Beardsley decree?
At the time of the Beardsley decree, there was a law that said if a party wished to change the points of diversion of his or her water right, then there was a requirement to have personal service upon certain defendants and then also publication service. The appellants will concede that if the Beardsley decree is a change of points of diversion, that the notice procedures were not followed. So it's really the crux issue of the appeal is what is the meaning of the Beardsley decree. Now, in the context of that lawsuit, then rather than plan to divert each other's water rights through headgates, what the parties instead were intending to do was what the court encouraged in Vihart Ranch v. Bagwell back in 1984. And there the court said that informal exchanges and mutual accommodations by owners of water rights occur frequently to permit maximum utilization of this critical resource. And that's what happened here. And It's important to know, a question has been raised, what did Bell, what did the owner of the Bell right, Mr. Bates, have to gain from this agreement? Because he had the number one priority on the stream. But it's important to recognize the context of the litigation, and that is that Beardsley had filed a lawsuit where if Beardsley was successful, the court was going to declare these were two separate streams, and the William Bell right would no longer be able to call out the ledgered rights on the north branch of the stream. And when the court sees how limited the supply is in the record, that's a major threat to the supply for the Bell number one. And so what the owner of the Bell number one gained by this settlement was certainty that the Bell number one would continue to be able to call the entire flow of the stream system of both branches at least every 4 days moving forward. And it eliminated that threat that the Bell's supply, the amount of water it could call for, would be severely curtailed with a declaration that there were two separate streams.
Would you just explain now the bifurcation? Is it the structure that was put on here that the state engineer wanted or the division engineer wanted, and how that works?
Yes. At the split point of the streams, there is now a physical structure. The water commissioner can use this structure to direct water into the north branch or into the main branch, or to split the flow between those branches as appropriate to meet the call that the water commissioner is trying to satisfy.
Is that just above Brandenburg, just below it? Where would you locate that for us?
Yes. It's, if the court would look maybe an inch and a half up the left side of the map and then a half an inch in, there's a group here that says Brandenburg number 6 and Jeske number 3. It's right at the corner of those two roads there, which are called Willows Lane and Schoolfield Road. That's where the split point occurred. And it's worth noting that before the bifurcation structure was installed, the administration of water rights between these branches functioned in the same way. It was just a somewhat lower tech method. The water commissioner would go up there and move rocks back and forth in order to direct the flow down one branch or direct the flow down the other. And the movement of rocks was becoming unsatisfactory. And so eventually he requested, and the parties below installed a structure that's a bit more fancy for that administration. Now, the water court erred below in declaring the Beardsley decree void. And it did this in several, there are several errors, and it's important to note each one. First, the water court accepted Brandenburg's allegations of fact. And that included the allegation that the only connection between these two branches was artificial, that they were separate stream systems. And the court below seized on that fact in the October 12th summary judgment order and emphasized that the diversion of water rights from one stream to another stream entirely created changes in points of diversion. And this, in so doing, the court disregarded evidence from the Locrustes that they submitted at the summary judgment stage. And that included the testimony of the longtime Valley resident, Ben Kettle. He was the former farmer of a rancher, I should say, of the Locrustes place, testifying that the streams had always been naturally connected to his knowledge. The Locrustes submitted a letter from the division engineer, Steve Witte, in 1990, a public record. And in 1990, Steve Witte had been asked the same question, are these two separate streams or is this a single stream system? And he analyzed historic documents and topographical maps and concluded they were the same stream system. And so these pieces of evidence submitted by the Locrustes at a minimum created a disputed issue of material fact, and the court disregarded that.
I have to ask this. So this was 10 years ago, right?
Yes.
So why didn't you do something about it then? I mean, what you said is absolutely accurate, that if there's a disputed issue of facts, summary judgment can't be granted. That's sort of basic Hornbook kind of stuff. So
that's correct.
So why not?
So the resolution of the Beardsley issue did not resolve all the issues in the case below. And the parties were gearing up for trial. The summary judgment motion was filed, and then the parties had a trial below. But the trial itself also did not resolve all the undisputed issues. And the unfortunate truth of the matter is that the Locrustes were ranchers, and they were just trying to be able to continue irrigating the way that they had. And they ran out of financial resources to continue to prosecute the action.
So post-trial, we now have a new order that sort of undoes at least the factual finding about the separate versus single stream systems.
Correct.
if I make sure I have the dates right, we have a summary judgment order in October 2000.
Yes.
We have a trial order and judgment in December 2001.
Correct.
And then nothing happens for 10 years. What? How does the administration continue post-trial judgment? And then why shouldn't this whole thing be dismissed at this point for not doing anything for 10 years?
The trial actually did not resolve all of the issues. The trial was primarily about the one-stream or two-stream issue. And so after the trial, it's not quite correct that nothing happened for 10 years, although very close to correct. The Loprestes entered into a new stipulation with the state engineers after trial that conformed their prior agreement to the facts found at trial. And then it's true that the case laid dormant for some time, and Mr. Brandenburg moved below to dismiss for lack of prosecution, and the court declined to do that and sympathized with Loprestes' position that they were unable to prosecute the action. The case has now been set for trial, and they're trying to move forward again.
So the idea of not prosecuting the action, but filing a 54B, why didn't you file a 54B? They couldn't afford the appeals, what you mean?
And yes, and
10 years ago?
Ten years ago, correct. There's an issue with affording the appeal, and there was an issue with trying to get through all of the action at once. So at least if there was an appeal, there was only going to be one. And it's worth noting here that Brandenburg requested the certification for appeal, the interlocutory appeal that's up before you now. And so this matter has sort of been forced to the forefront now.
But there was no final judgment, no final findings, conclusions, decree, and judgment? I mean,
not on all of the claims in the application, no.
Okay.
It was a judgment that resolved some of the issues. It resolved the alternate point of diversion issue, not in favor of the Loprestes, and they have not appealed that here. But there is the remaining issue of trying. If you look at the original decree and see the points of diversion and then the places that are irrigated, they just don't match at all. Like, the irrigated land will be on the opposite side of the stream. And so what remains is the Loprestes' claim to try and correct some of those clerical errors in order to have the decree and their ability to call for water rights fit with the facts, with the geography.
Once the trial court entered the order and judgment finding this to be a single stream system, and given that that contradicted the earlier finding, if you will, in the summary judgment order, what efforts, if any, did the Loprestes make to try to resolve that discrepancy? Did they seek any kind of review at the water court to resolve that discrepancy?
There's not a motion for reconsideration below, if that's what you're asking, but the Colorado law says that there's not a requirement anymore for a motion for a new trial in order to preserve a point of error. And I agree that the trial court judgment, the December 2001 judgment, is somewhat confusing in that it says these are two stream systems, and then it proclaims that the shifting of water back and forth between these stream systems does not change points of diversion, and so it seems to completely undo the summary judgment order. But then just a few paragraphs later in the conclusions of law, the court reiterates the voidness of the Beardsley decree. And admittedly, the water court did not have the benefit of this court's decision in Inglewood v. Burlington at the time that he made that conclusion, but that's what provides this court with an opportunity to correct that error. And I want to emphasize the two practical implications of correcting the error below this far down the road. And the first is that with the alternate point of diversion claim dismissed, ability to rotate water back and forth is incredibly important for the Loprestes for irrigation. It's more essential because they can't take their water through the main branch. And also, the effect of this order voiding the Beardsley decree has cast a cloud over the quantification of the historic consumptive use of these water rights. And Fountain and Widefield have a change case pending below. It's been stayed while this appeal is decided. And that change case involves the Bell Number 1. And in that case, Brandenburg has filed basically the same motion that he filed in the Loprestes case and questioned how the quantification of these rights can be made if the use was under a void decree.
Could you address your opponent's argument on the procedural grounds that we only should be considering what evidence was before the court on the motion for summary judgment?
Yes, my time is running low, but I'll do that. The all the parties appealed the conclusion that the Beardsley decree is void. And so there's two answers. The first is that there's error apparent at the time that summary judgment was granted, but that correcting that error wouldn't resolve the issue. And frankly, there's also no need for a remand to determine the disputed issue of fact of one stream versus two stream, because there's already been a trial on that issue. And then after trial, the court reiterated that the Beardsley decree is void. So that's another issue that's up on appeal, and therefore it's proper for the court to consider the entire record. And so for the foregoing reasons, this court should reverse the water court's conclusion that the Beardsley decree is void and remand for further proceedings on the Lopresti's remaining claim to correct clerical errors. I'll reserve the remainder of our time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, I'm Wayne Schroeder, and I represent John Brandenburg and the people called Brandon and also James Hood. We believe there are two issues before the court. The first issue is whether you ought to affirm the judgment declaring the Beardsley decree void. The second issue is, assuming you do that, whether we're entitled to attorney's fees in this case. We press that point. We press the point because the appellants have switched their position from the trial court to the Supreme Court. They have told us a moment ago that their allegations of fact are two separate streams that were presented to the court. Now, before the court ordered before the court declared the Beardsley decree void, it had before it three motions. The first motion I filed in April, as I recall, of 2000, and that motion was for an order declaring void in limine the Beardsley decree. It was called a motion in limine. A little later, the state engineer and the division engineer reached a stipulation with the Lopresti's, and I used that stipulation thereafter, and I filed another motion to declare the, this is a motion now for summary judgment, that's the motion that the judge actually ruled on. I asked the judge to declare as a matter of law on a summary judgment motion that the Beardsley decree was void, and in that motion I said this will void the first, not void, it'll moot the first motion. That is, we had at that time still a third motion pending, and that was a motion for summary judgment dismissing a major portion of the Lopresti application to change water rights. So in December, he had before him three motions. One motion in limine to declare the Beardsley decree void, which I had said, Judge, if you grant my motion on summary judgment, you will moot any need to address that in limine motion. The judge then entered two orders on December 10th. They're back-to-back orders. They probably ought to be considered together because, after all, they involve the same case, same judge, all the facts were before him. And the judge granted two summary judgment orders. One's called Order Granting Summary Judgment Reference 1908 Beardsley Decree. The other one is called dismissing portions of the application. Now, I relied, when I did the motion for summary judgment, I relied on the stipulation that the state engineer, the division engineer, and the Lopresti's had entered. And these are the facts that were presented to the court. They're in a document called, plus a lot of attachments. I think the attachments are a half inch or three quarter inch thick. This is Objector Brandenburg's Rule 56 motion for summary judgment declaring void the 1908 Beardsley decree. We proposed to the judge that there was no factual issue, no genuine factual issue, contrary to what you just heard from counsel. Counsel told you that we had asserted the proposition there are two separate streams. We didn't do that. Here's what we did. We said there's no genuine issues of all material facts which are established by the pleadings.
I'm sorry, Mr. Schroeder, I'm just confused. Yeah, first of all, I thought the summary judgment motion that was granted was in October. And secondly, I don't understand what document you're talking about. So could you?
There are three documents. Motions.
I'm concerned about, you just said it was a matter of law, right? It was based on a stipulation, you said? Now, what are you talking about?
Well, I'm going to go through that now.
Well, I'd like to read it as you talk, so you can refer to it.
If you're reading something, you ought to, respectfully, Judge, you ought to be, or Justice, you ought to be reading the Objector Brandenburg's Rule 56 motion for summary judgment. And that's in the record at 319-44650. 319-44650. On the second page, I said that applicants state in their verified amended application that, and this is the facts that we presented to the judge, to the court at that time. Now, these are, this statement that I'm about to give you comes out of their verified amended application. It was signed by the consulting engineer. It says applicants and their predecessors have found it necessary to divert a number of the ledgered ditch water rights from alternate distributaries in order to fully utilize them at their historical places of use. In fact, applicants and their predecessors have diverted the ledger ditch number 11 and 12 from the decreed points of diversion for the ledger ditch number 5 since at least 1909 under a decree entered in Beardsley and so forth. So the applicants, well, Prestes reached an agreement with the state engineer and the division engineer as to how that old 1908 Beardsley decree had been operated. And they wrote that out. They stipulated. I just copied it. I presented it to the judge in the motion for summary judgment. Going a little further, I said in the applicant's proposed findings of fact, this was where they agreed with the division engineer. They said the Beardsley decree required delivery of water rights with decreed sources on Ledger Creek down the main stem of Neve Creek. And they proposed on page 15, paragraph 26, nothing in this decree is intended to change or otherwise affect the Beardsley decree and the administration of water rights under it. Applicants will and may continue to divert and use water in accordance with that decree and so forth. Then at C on page 2 of this motion, I said, in the May 19 stipulated decree with the engineers, the applicants and the engineers agree that, and I quote from this, nothing in the decree is intended to change or otherwise affect the Beardsley decree and the rotation of water rights under it. This is the point that counsel says is wrong. He says this is not really a rotation of water rights decree. They characterized it themselves as rotation of water rights under it. Continuing, applicants will and may continue to divert and use water in accordance with that decree after entry of decree in this case. They entered a fairly substantial stipulation, which I called to the court's attention. The stipulation, an order approving the stipulation, is in the record at 3188-7886. And the stipulation itself, signed by the division engineer, the state engineer, and the Prestes, is in the record at 3188-7267. So these are the facts I presented to the judge. We did not present to the judge any contention at all that they're two separate streams, contrary to what you just heard. When counsel said, we did that, he didn't give you a citation or anything. They do the same thing in the brief. There's no citation to any evidence or any factual statement that I presented to the judge that suggested two separate streams in this motion. It just doesn't appear. In the applicant's proposed findings of fact, conclusions of law, judgment and decree, parentheses May 19 in parentheses 2000, signed by the applicants, not signed by the judge, but signed by the applicants and the division engineer, they said, at page 8 in paragraph 16, that the defendant owners of the W.A. Bell Ditch number 1 argued that the streams were not separate or distinct but constituted the same source. Therefore, they could lawfully call water from Ledger Creek to satisfy their Neve Creek priority. The suit was resolved by decree and so forth, in which the court, after making factual findings, adopted the agreement between the owners of the Ledger Ditch water rights and the owners of the Bell number 1 to rotate between them on consecutive four-day periods during the irrigation season, all of the water available under the priorities decreed to the W.A. Bell number ditch and the Ledger ditches 5, 11, and 12. the court, this is now the applicants discussing and reaching agreement with the division engineer and the state engineer. The court found that the rotation, that's the word they used in the decree, or in their stipulated decree, that is, will not increase the burden for diversion of waters for irrigation and so forth and so forth. So they're saying to each other here, and you're agreeing, this is a rotation of water rights. All the water available to all four priorities can go to the bell number one for 4 days. All the water available to all four priorities can go somewhere else.
So can I interrupt you just a minute here to make sure I understand where you're going?
Sure.
So are you saying then that the ruling on summary judgment didn't find that there were two streams, and in fact the judge basically just considered that part irrelevant because it was finding that even if it was one stream, that the agreement allowed diversion of water from some points that was decreed to other points?
Precisely.
Okay, so basically the thrust of what you're saying is it really doesn't make any difference whether it's two streams or one stream. The whole thing turns on whether the agreement allowed diversion at some point, water that was decreed to be diverted at another point.
That's correct. It doesn't make any difference at all whether it's two streams or one stream or whatever.
Excuse me, however, the court's order, October 12th of 2000, makes a big point that these were two entirely separate streams.
No, it doesn't, Your Honor.
It doesn't.
If you've got the same order granting summary judgment reference 1908 Beers of the Decree that I have, it says on page 1, the Beers of the Decree outlines the streams and water rights affected as being one from Cheese Factory Creek, also called Neve Creek, the W.A. Bell Ditch number 1, and Ledger Ditch number 5.
No, next page. Diversion 1, diversion of water under rights relating to a particular stream, with said rights further relating to particular identified lands to be irrigated to another stream entirely to be used to irrigate lands not at all associated with the decreed rights.
Hey, you got to read the first page, though, too.
Read it together for me. What does that second part mean?
The second part, to another stream entirely,
right.
You can put it in the context of the first page, and it'll say, for example, from Neve Creek to Ledger Creek. Or it'll say from Main Branch to North Branch. There's three separate streams that the judge very carefully delineated here. One's called Cheese Factory Stream Creek, that is, on which there are two water rights, W.A. Bell Ditch and Ledger Ditch number 5. And then the next stream that he's talking about is Main Branch of Ledger Creek. And the next one he's talking about is North Branch of Ledger Creek. They're three separate streams. They're connected. There's no allegation anywhere. They're separate streams. They are connected streams. But even if they were not connected, even if they're separate streams, Justice Coates, it doesn't make any difference. You can't move water from one point of diversion to another point of diversion without having a change decree. And as you heard from counsel, the change decree requires personal notice and also qualification at that time. And that's the reason that the judge found no notice.
How does a no-call agreement function?
Well, this no-call agreement functions the way they said it agreed. I'm sorry, the way they said it functioned. And I'll read to you now how they say it functioned. Among other things, this is on page 13 now. Now I'm back to the draft stipulation, the draft stipulated decree that was more than a draft, it was signed. On page 13, they say, as a consequence, the diversion records maintained by the Division of Water Resources do not accurately affect what water rights were used or the lands the water rights was used to irrigate. Likewise, those records do not reflect the rotation of water practice under the Beers of the Decree and so forth. And they say these failures are immaterial here because the Bell Ditch and the Ledger Ditches 5 to 9 are entitled to a combined diversion of 13.4 second feet and so forth and so forth. Then, as regards how it operated, there's more explanation. Again, this is an agreement between the two parties. In paragraph 32, the practice of William Charles Kettle, whose family owned the Boyer Ranch from 1929 to 1960, was to essentially take all water lawfully available in priority to the Ledger Ditches down the main stem of Neve Creek to either Ledger 5 or down the north fork of Neve Creek to Ledger number 8 point of diversion. And going a little further now, at page 16, paragraph 36, the parties agreed in this stipulated decree that they filed, and the court approved it, as a matter of fact, over my objection. It said nothing in this decree is intended to change or otherwise affect the Beerza decree and the rotation of water rights under it. Applicants will and may continue to divert and use water in accordance with that decree after entry of a decree in this case. So they're setting the thing up to continue the Beerza decree effectively in perpetuity. This stipulation was filed, according to the filing stamp, June 9. I just used it, and I tossed back to the judge all the facts that these parties had agreed to. Based on that, he entered two orders. The one order granting summary judgment says that, at the second sentence, this ruling renders moot the motion in limine related to the same subject matter filed May 5, 2000. And of course, I'd ask him to do that. The court finds there are no genuine issues and so forth, and the court finds that there was no notice, and the court says it does not matter what initial relief the parties to the earlier action, now this is 1908 now, is referring back to the initial earlier action. It matters only what the Beerza decree wrought with this decree, and whether the court, with the ultimate result of the decree in mind, had subject matter jurisdiction to accomplish that result. It did not. Whether the agreement reached between Beardsley and Bates might also be characterized as a loan of water or rotation agreement simply begs the exact question posed by objector Brandenburg's motion. The Beardsley court is plainly approving a de facto change in points of diversion as to four separate water rights from three named streams. And you recall I named the streams a second ago. That's on the first page. At page 2 of the Beerza decree, it is said that the matter of the construction of the alleged artificial channel mentioned in the complaint is immaterial. So the judge, this is a 1908 judge, and this judge now is concurring with the 1908 judge and saying it doesn't make any difference whether they're separate streams or all related streams. The result is the same. They're changing water from one point of diversion to another one.
Let's take it. We go with you there. Then, sure. What is the reason in your mind, in your argument, why the construction of the agreement, why opposing counsel's construction of the agreement is not a reasonable one and valid one? That is, that even the words of that limit, although they allow diversion, you know, a choice of points of diversion, that they do not allow, the agreement does not allow diversion of more than was lawfully decreed to that point of diversion.
Well, the reason that the stipulation is important is because the stipulation between the parties establishes that all the water can be diverted at one point, at any one of the four points.
And maybe you could sort of embellish on that. Mm-hmm. Well, how does it do that? Isn't that what your opponents are arguing it does not do?
Well, sure, they're arguing it does not do. That's contrary to the testimony of the assistant division engineer who said...
Do you think the engineer can decide what the agreement means?
No, he wasn't deciding what the agreement means. He's simply saying how it worked.
So that's some evidence of how it was being applied, at least at some point
in time.
That's
some evidence of how it was being applied, but the other evidence of how it was being applied is contained in the stipulation. These are called judicial omissions. They also said in the briefs there's been no judicial omissions. The judge found in the second order granting summary judgment on the change of points of diversion, he found these are judicial omissions. The judge told them then, you can't argue contrary to what you just stipulated to, and he's referring again to the stipulated decree. So that is evidence, a judicial admission is evidence that the judge could rely on.
And I'm sorry, I haven't had a chance to read all that record. So the admission, the judge found there was a judicial admission by your opponents that water could be diverted at any point of diversion, even though it was not lawfully decreed to that point of diversion?
That's what they agreed to. That's what they said the decree meant. That's how they said it operated. And the judge said that is a judicial omission.
I suppose we'll have to read it. We'll have to construe it, right? We'll have to construe it. We'll have to construe the intent and meaning of that stipulation, whether or not they changed the Beardsley decree or not, or whether they're simply describing what the Beardsley decree does.
Well, they're describing what the Beardsley decree does. They stipulated and agreed upon what the Beardsley decree does.
Okay, well, we can read that.
Sure.
Now, I'd like you to explain to the court how, why in some circumstances you should be able with your neighbors to rotate the head of the water. Isn't that a common practice?
It's a common practice, but when it's decreed by the judge, then it becomes more than just a common practice. Then it becomes a legal right. So the question is then whether they actually have a legal right. The judge below, this is Judge Anderson, said no, they don't have a legal right because they didn't follow the statutes in 1908 in order to obtain a legal right.
Do you mean certain parties can't make an agreement among themselves that they're going to rotate the head of the water to optimize the use of the water? Is that what you're saying?
It happens all the time, Your Honor.
Okay. But when you go in and decree that, suddenly it becomes a change of water rights.
When you go in and decree it, becomes a change of water rights. It becomes a change in point of diversion.
And tell me why this Beardsley decree, not mentioning the points, not mentioning the amounts, and just talking about rotating the head of the water on certain days for certain periods of time, why that is a change of water rights?
Well, because the judge at that time in 1908 is describing this as the right to divert all of the water at one point for a period of 4 days, and thereafter for another 4 days, the other guy gets the right to divert all of the water. It seems to me that.
But is the water in excess of what the decreed right at the ditch that's then taking it in the rotational round enlarged in any way?
Clearly it's in excess.
How?
Well, because if you can divert all the water and operate, let's say 12 second feet, for rough purposes, the early water rights total up to 12 second feet. If you divert all the 12 second feet at one point of diversion to irrigate maybe 200 acres, let's say, you've got an awful lot of water on the 200 acres.
But you're not enlarging. If you don't enlarge the acreage, presumably the return flow is going to get back into the system, right? And you got the number one right down there that could call all of this, presumably, in a low water year, into its headgate, basically saying, I'm not going to do that so that you all can enjoy the advantages of your right. Right now, so what's wrong with that?
Well, here's what's wrong with it, according to Judge Anderson, back again to the order granting summary judgment regarding 1908 Beardsley Decree. The Beardsley Court is plainly approving a de facto change in points of diversion as to four separate rights from three named streams. At page 2 of the Beardsley Decree, it said the matter of the construction of the alleged artificial channel is immaterial and so forth. Whether or not that observation is correct, and this is the point that I'd like to make, it remains plain that water is decreed for irrigation purposes from particular streams to particular ditches for application to specific acreages or somehow inappropriately diverted into other streams to be applied to other.
Then a year later, he says it's one stream.
Well, I'm sorry.
A year later, he says it's one stream. He corrects himself and says it's one stream.
He didn't correct himself, Your Honor.
Well, then what was the meaning of that order a year later?
Well,
after trial.
Yes. He says, now this is a document called Order and Judgment. I don't have the reference number, but it's an order and judgment entered December 5, 2001. This is the second judgment, also by Judge Anderson. He goes through findings of fact, and he describes the same creeks and branches and so forth that he had described earlier. He says Alvarado Creek splits at Rose Lane and so forth. The waters of each flow into other distributary streams. He's using the word other streams. There's a flock of streams up there in that particular little part of the valley. There's lots of streams. He says that researching its findings that there is but a single stream source, the court has placed great reliance on what is obviously to be seen on the modern maps and evidence. So he's finding a single stream system, but within the single stream system are individual streams. They're branches. They're called North Branch, Mean Channel, Weave Creek, and so forth. They got all kinds of names for them, but they're all individually decreed. The water rights for example, Ledger 5, are being diverted by the Bell Number 1, and they're being applied to lands that are decreed for irrigation under the Bell Number 1. That's a change in water right. Any way you cut it, it's a change in water right, Justice Hobbs, because after all, you're not supposed to take water decreed to one ditch, remove it from the ditch, take the same water out of another point of diversion on another ditch and apply it to the lands there. That's usually called a change in water right or a change in place of location and so forth. There's no question at all it's a change of water right. The judge had no difficulty at all with that principle.
Could I follow up on that just one second, kind of going back and forth to the points that interest us here? It seems to me your opponents, though, are saying, well, this agreement fairly can be read to say when it's your 4 days, you can divert any place that you could lawfully divert, and when it's our 4 days, we can divert from any diversion point that we could lawfully divert, but not that we could unlawfully divert from any other point. Now, you said you thought they stipulated that that was not what the agreement meant.
They stipulated.
And we'll look at that. But if we were not to agree that there was a stipulation that did away with this issue, is there some reason why the agreement cannot be reasonably construed to mean what your opponents say it means?
Well, the agreement has to be construed in the context of how it was operated for 100 years.
And Is that right?
I think it's right. They agreed.
Later operation may be evidence of what the agreement was intended to mean and what it says on its face, but surely it can't determine what the agreement meant, can it?
I think, Your Honor, where the agreement is ambiguous, and suffice to say there's been enough litigation over the agreement, probably so that judges could conclude as a matter of law that it's ambiguous, you got to look at how it was actually implemented. Now, I suggest also, following up on one of the justices' comments a little while ago, that the court shouldn't look beyond 2000, you know, October, when it entered the decree. I'm sorry, when the judge entered the decree. Because we're getting then, the court then is being asked to consider arguments never made to the trial judge in this case. If, for example, the argument is, well, gee, judge, you ought to consider all the evidence in 2001 when you tried the case, that's the addition of facts to an argument that was made a year earlier in 2000. You shouldn't be able to do that, and that's one of the points, of course, that we made.
I'm not understanding that at all, because if the matter is still before the court, certainly the court could reconsider whether or not the grant of summary judgment was correct or any other motions, right? I mean, the law of the case doesn't apply until there's a final judgment. There's no final judgment in this case, apparently, yet. Isn't that right?
There is a final judgment, yes, Your Honor. There's a final judgment by reason of Rule 54B. There's a final judgment.
Well, that's for the appealing that right. Particular issue. I'm talking about the case apparently is still open. I mean, why this case's language is troublesome. But the fact of the matter is, doesn't a judge get to change his or her decision while the case is still before him or her if it turns out to be wrong or something else?
Absolutely.
Happens? Okay.
Absolutely. The judge may very well have done that. We don't know if right. The evidence had been sufficiently strong, and if the evidence had been presented to that judge, maybe he would have done that. He didn't reconsider the motion for summary judgment in 2001. He referred to it and said, I've previously ordered that this thing is void. But he didn't reconsider it. Nobody asked him to reconsider it. That's why one of the justices asked a little while ago, why didn't you ask for reconsideration? The reason there was no request for reconsideration, presumably, is because the parties kind of lost interest after they lost two motions for summary judgment. And thereafter, they proceeded a trial on one part. They were successful in 2001, but that didn't undo any of the parts of the summary judgment that had, or any of the parts of the two summary judgments that have been entered. You need to look at both summary judgments. The one summary judgment has on its face that they have judicially admitted certain things. And the judge says you can't judicially admit stuff and then change your mind, which is what they're doing here. The only reason that this case is now before the Supreme Court is because Widefield in Fountain bought a piece of the bill number one. And they were allowed to intervene.
Wait a minute, it's before the court because you filed a 54B motion.
Well, we filed a 54B motion. They, being Widefield, brought the appeal. They were allowed to intervene in the case over our objection after the two summary judgment orders had been in effect for some 10 years. They were allowed to intervene. The judge said, that's okay, they can intervene. And the judge said also, that's okay. He denied our motion to dismiss for lack of prosecution. So we're stuck then with at least a 54B order, which we had requested, so as to get some finality into the case. And that's the result. The case is now before you, but it's brought before you by a party that had never any interest in the case in the first place, Widefield and Fountain. And Widefield and Fountain are now saying, gee,
There are certain things that should have been done, certain arguments that should have been made. None of those arguments were ever made to the water judge back in 2000. They could have said, "Judge, you've got this thing all messed up," but they didn't do that. They didn't ask for reconsideration. So we have, fortunately, now a final judgment on the two orders. Actually, there was a final judgment on several orders, but the only two before the court are the motion, that is, the order granting summary judgment, two of them, one to dismiss points of diversion application, the other one dealing with the validity of the Beardsley decree. Those two summary judgments were done the same day. They ought to be read together because one of them says you can't change your mind. You just can't stipulate to one thing such as they did.
Is your plan in this change of water rights case that Fountain and Whitefield are?
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
To figure out what the consumptive use is?
Sure.
And our decision here is going to affect how much consumption?
Our decision here is going to affect that because they've also stipulated in the underlying decree here, they've also stipulated with the division engineer, there are no accurate records for diversions. These are stipulations of fact. And so they're going to have a difficult problem anyway proving up their change case because they've already stipulated with each other there's no accurate diversion records available. I have 16 seconds left, and unless you have a question, I'm going to reserve, can't reserve any time, but I've got 11 seconds left if you have any additional
questions. Are you loaning those?
Pardon me?
Excuse me.
I can loan them. The appellant, if he wishes, can have my 11 seconds.
It's up now. Thank you very much, Mr. Schroeder. Rebuttal?
I appreciate the loan of the seconds. Let me just make a few brief points on rebuttal. First, Fountain and Whitefield intervened in this case when Brandenburg began to seek a Rule 54B certification, and it became clear this is the one opportunity. This is the appeal that's going to determine the lawfulness of the Beardsley decree. Let me also point to a few places in the record where Brandenburg alleged that there were separate streams below. First, in his motion in limine, which preceded the motion for summary judgment on the same topic.
Oh, wait a minute. Why don't you address the stipulation, which I haven't read. Did you judicially admit that there were, or your predecessors in interest, I say? What was the judicial admissions? I think that's critical.
There was no admission. The Loprestes accepted that they did not have records of diversion to support their alternate points claim. That has been dismissed. But I want to emphasize that if the Loprestes believed that the Beardsley decree authorized alternate points of diversion, there was no need for them to include the alternate point of diversion claim in this case below. And that claim is the very claim that's included in the proposed decree and the stipulation that Brandenburg's pointing to. So it's clear that the Loprestes did not view the Beardsley decree that way. And I see that my time is up, if I may briefly conclude. In conclusion, the appellants would urge this court to reverse the judgment of the Beardsley decree as well and to deny the claim for attorney's fees because this appeal has merit. Thank you very much.
Case will stand submitted and the court will take it.